It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, State Representative Chris Taylor recently went to Burlington, Vermont to hear how that community feels about F-35 fighter jets stationed there. We'll talk to Taylor about what she learned and what it means for a plan to station some of the same jets here in Wisconsin. First, grief is something that impacts pretty much everybody at some point. It's part of the human experience, the feeling after losing someone you were close to. But our next guest realized that for such a universal experience, grief can feel pretty lonely. Two Baltimore-based mental health professionals decided there was a space and a need for more resources for people living with grief, so they created the website What's Your Grief? Litza Williams and Eleanor Haley join us now. Litza, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Eleanor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you. We're glad to be here.
Litza, to get us started, tell us a little more about how and why you two started What's Your Grief?
Sure. Eleanor and I both have backgrounds in mental health and grief and bereavement, and we were working in Baltimore with families who had experienced, for the most part, traumatic and unexpected losses. And we had the privilege and really unique experience of working with families from the time of death at the hospital with a loved one through 2 years of grief and bereavement aftercare services. And in doing that, we realized just how diverse the needs of people who are grieving are. We realized just different styles, different interest in things like in-person support and support groups, counseling versus finding other ways to cope. And we started developing more and more of an interest in some non-traditional ways to support people who were grieving beyond just in-person counseling and support groups. And from doing that, What's Your Grief was sort of born. We joke that we complained for a long time about not being able to find things online that worked for us and feeling like from our own personal experiences with grief and loss combined with the professional experience that we really saw there was a gap there and just set out to fill that.
Eleanor, as Litza mentioned, you both had personal experiences, I think, around the same time with loss that helped, in addition to your professional efforts, help drive the creation of What's Your Grief. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We both experienced the death of a parent in early adulthood, though Litza was a little bit younger. She was in late teens, I believe, Litza. And I was in my early 20s, but we were in a similar stage of life. And we were working, in the years afterwards. And so oftentimes what the litmus test would be for the types of support that we wanted to offer would this have been something that resonated with us in our grief? Would this have been something that we would have read? Would this be a community that we would engage with? And so What's Your Grief very much came from the lack of being able to find certain things that would have appealed to us. Quite often, the go-to suggestion for grief support is support groups, which are wonderful in many ways, but there are many people who are never going to step foot in a support group. And so for people like that, we want to look at other outlets and other ways. And I think those are the ways that also resonate with us. Things like creative expression, things like continuing your bond with your loved one through different kinds of rituals and events and things like that. So we were very much, our practice is very much informed by our own personal experiences as well as our professional training.
And Litza, you mentioned the diversity of experience of people dealing with grief. It sounds like it would be impossible to come up with a one size fits all approach because it affects people differently.
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest misconceptions about grief is that it's going to look similar or the same for everyone. I think some of those old grief models that caught on very early on, things like the five stages of grief, created this idea that we could predict what grief might look like, where there's a series of stages that we're all going to go through. And we know now that that's not the way that grief works. Those theories can be helpful, and there can be information, things that we can take them from them that are useful. But I think that idea that it created a feeling that there's a universal experience, it's simply not how grief works. And it's not how coping works. We all cope so differently. Some people really love to talk about their feelings and their emotions, and they process things a little more externally and emotionally. And some people are a little bit more analytical, a little more cognitive, rational. You know, they look for more kind of physical and concrete ways to cope, and lots of creative outlets for coping. And so the range and diversity is huge in both how we grieve and how we cope with all difficult things.
Eleanor, can it lead to guilt if people feel like, oh, I'm doing grief wrong. I see everybody else is, it's supposed to be this way, but I feel this way.
Oh my goodness, yes. Their guilt is such a huge experience for people who are grieving for many reasons, both guilt towards the experience of how the person engaged with their loved one while they were alive and when they died. And then, as you mentioned, through feelings of maybe doubt about oneself and shame about how one is grieving. Oftentimes, people encourage people to be strong, to move on. They look at them sort of oddly if they have been talking about their grief and struggling for what somebody or society might deem as quote unquote too long. So people oftentimes do feel a number of negative feelings, including grief or guilt, about how their grief is progressing. And what one of the main things that we have wanted to do with our website is to just normalize that grief is so many different things. And no matter how long or how your grief is manifesting itself, so many of these experiences are normal and it's okay. And your people are doing the best that they can. So yeah, absolutely. Guilt is a big, big topic within our practice.
We're talking to Eleanor Haley and Litza Williams, creators of the website, What's Your Grief? Litza, a common theme in some of the things you have on your website and comments from your audience, your community there is like the mundane and surprising ways the grief affects people. It's not just the sadness with grief. It can have all these unexpected symptoms in people's daily lives.
Oh, yeah. I think one of the biggest things that draws people to our website when we can go and look at what did people Google to end up here is oftentimes just them saying, I'm grieving and I'm not crying. You know, what's that about? Or I'm feeling anger, or I'm feeling anxiety, or, you know, I'm feeling all these different feelings and I'm trying to figure out, is that normal or is that not normal? So grief is so much more than sadness. It is so many different feelings. I think the other thing people often find is that grief triggers are everywhere. It's not just the big things that we imagine are going to bring up that feeling of sadness and missing our loved one and yearning to be able to talk to them again. That come to mind. Often it's walking into a store and there's a song playing and just all of a sudden you kind of have a meltdown and have to abandon your shopping cart and go out into the parking lot and you don't see it coming. And so I think we find a lot of people who find us through that experience of feeling like, is this normal or is this a sign that I'm losing it, that I'm having these unusual feelings or experiences cropping up when, as Eleanor said, so much of this is normal. And so that's what we try to normalize on our site is just, you're not losing it. This is just part of how grief works.
Well, speaking of those things that can trigger that memory even well after the fact, Eleanor, I think it was you wrote about the deathiversary, the anniversary of someone's death, and how to deal with that and maybe make rituals around that. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. I think one of the things when people say, how do we support a friend or a family member who's grieving, we, of course, talk about the things you can do in the immediate. But one of the things that we always emphasize is the importance of that year mark for many people and checking in around that time. Because for many people, that is such a difficult time of year. And it's not always just that day in particular. It might be the weeks and the days that lead up to that day. You might reflect back on what were you doing this a year ago at this time. And so it is such a big day, and it can really be a day that brings on a sense of dread for people who are grieving somebody. And so we do encourage people to spend the day in a way that they feel comfortable with. We say that it's okay if you want to take the day to feel very, you know, to feel very bad and cry and stay inside, and that's okay. But we do encourage people to at least find a few ways, if not just one way, to really honor and connect with their loved one. And it doesn't have to be something big. It doesn't have to be a big party or a memorial or a celebration of life or anything like that. It can be the smallest thing, like on this day, I'm going to go to one place that makes me feel close to my loved one, or I'm going to make sure to tell a stranger one story about my loved one, or I'm going to sit down and write a letter to my loved one and tell them all the things that have changed over the years since they've died. And so there are so many different little ways, and we do encourage people to just find a few things or one thing that they can do on that day to connect with their loved one.
We're talking to mental health professionals Litza Williams and Eleanor Haley. They're the creators of the website What's Your Grief? Helping people talk about and cope with grief in their lives and the diversity of experiences people have with grief. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guests about dealing with loss? Do you have a question about how to act or support someone you know who's grieving a loss in their life? What has surprised you over time about the impact of grief on your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with a pair of mental health professionals, Litza Williams and Eleanor Haley. They are the co-founders of the website What's Your Grief? And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has it been difficult at some point in your life to talk about grief or the loss of a loved one? What helped you, if anything, work through, deal with your grief? Do you have questions for our guest about how all this stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Litza, Eleanor had mentioned people supporting friends and loved ones dealing with grief themselves. And I saw on your website there was you have a list of words that we need in dealing with grief, and one word was head tilters. And I've been guilty of this, the person who tilts their head and talks slowly and sadly and supportively. And that's not necessarily a great way to help somebody out. What's a better way to support someone, Litza?
Yeah, I think this is really well-intentioned. I think everyone is really well-intentioned, often in supporting another person who is grieving. We just often don't know what to do and what to say. And so one of the things that we really encourage people to do is just know that it can just be a normal part of conversation, and that we can, you know, be able to talk about this without tilting our heads and talking in soft voices, and just acknowledge that we're not going to be able to change or fix what a person is going through, but we can be there for them. We can be there to listen to them. One thing that we know people often, the inclination to do, is to try to find a silver lining or to sometimes minimize what somebody's going through. So we always joke, you know, if you're about to start a sentence with "at least," you should probably stop. You know, at least he lived a long life. At least you can get remarried. You know, People say all sorts of things that I think in the moment are well-intended to try to find something positive or something to hold on to. But in that moment when someone has lost someone, really what they need most is just that validation that this is the worst thing that ever could have happened to them, and that you understand that, and that you'll just be there to walk alongside them, be there in whatever way they need, but not try to, you know, find that silver lining for someone in a moment where sometimes they just need someone to be there for them.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mary Beth is with us in New Berlin. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Mary Beth?
Well, you were talking about triggers, and after my husband died, I went to the grocery store on Valentine's Day, and there was this just adorable young person selling Valentine candy, and he took my breath away. I just stood there going, I don't have a Valentine. You know, and I was so surprised by that reaction, because it was definitely a trigger.
Mary Beth, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. And Eleanor, Mary Beth is not alone, right? That trigger can come out of nowhere for people.
Oh, no, certainly not. I think many people have that experience where they're very surprised by what the trigger is. And it does, like she said, it takes your breath away. And that's why we hear from people all the time that they were in a store and something caught them off guard and they had to leave. It was so effective. And so I think that when we talk about triggers, there are two types: the ones that catch us off guard, like those unexpected grief triggers, and then the ones we can sort of anticipate. And you mentioned Valentine's Day. So, and that, you know, is a holiday for many people, and many people will have different traditions and memories associated with those days. And we're coming into November and December, where we will be celebrating many other holidays. And so we encourage anybody listening to just think about what are some of those triggers that might be expected, or that we might, you know, might catch us off guard. If we think about them ahead of time, sometimes we're able to anticipate and we're able to plan what we'll do when those things do sort of hit us, because we can't avoid all the grief triggers. If we did, we would just have to stay home. We will encounter these things, and sometimes we can feel a little bit stronger and a little more brave when we know how we'll handle them when we encounter them.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Maureen with us in La Crosse. Maureen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Maureen?
Well, my parents, first of all, I'm an older adult. I'm 70 years old.
and I lost both my parents, who were in their 90s, in 2014, within like an eight month period. And they had, up until that time, both been extremely healthy, and I was extremely close to them. I don't have children of my own. And it has had a profound effect on me. It seems strange, but I never even thought about them leaving, which I know sounds silly, but I guess it was denial. And I guess what I'm saying is that sometimes I do bring it up now and then, but I feel silly in a way that an older adult should be going through this kind of grief when they've had their parents around for such a long time.
Maureen, thank you so much for sharing that story. It doesn't sound silly to me. Litsa, what do you think?
No, Maureen, I think that one of the things that often happens, Ken Doka, who's a grief researcher, gave us this word called disenfranchised grief, when we feel like society doesn't validate our grief in the way that we would hope. I think often that happens with older adults, when the reality is, when you've had your parents with you for 70 years of your life, to imagine what it means to lose people who've been with you for so long, in many ways, they're often more deeply integrated into what your life has looked like for so many years. And so I think it is not at all silly. And I think that it's really important that we talk more about this idea that whether it is someone who is an older adult or much younger, that many times we really don't anticipate what life will feel like when they're gone. Even though we know in theory they may not always be with us, we can't anticipate what that will feel like. So one of the things we talk a lot about on our site is this idea of secondary losses. Oftentimes we don't realize that we lose the person who's been our cheerleader, or like our companion who we talk to on the phone every day. Or sometimes we feel like that person we were a caregiver in some way to them, and so our identity has been connected with them. So we've got the loss of the person, but we've often got these many other parts of our lives that change because of that loss. And so it can have a ripple effect into so many different areas and impact us very deeply at any age.
Thanks so much for sharing that story, Maureen. We are talking to Litsa Williams and Eleanor Haley. They're the co-founders of the grief website community, What's Your Grief? Back to your calls now. Ray is with us in Eagle River. Ray, hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I lost my mother back in February, and my life seems to be so full that I feel as if I haven't really processed the loss of my mother. And I've found a couple of triggering events just recently, and I believe that I'm experiencing delayed grief. And I'm wondering about if you have any words of wisdom you could share where I could start to really get in touch with my grief and really experience the loss in a healthy way.
Ray, thanks for the call. Eleanor?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to say without really being able to have a longer conversation. Something we would often look into if we're talking to somebody who's having these feelings is we would look into, is it avoidance? Is the person avoiding their loss? And is the person avoiding reminders of their loss? And if the answer to that is yes, then we would certainly encourage somebody who's experiencing this to find more opportunities to connect with memories, to connect with some of those emotions that they're experiencing. Maybe it's through things like journaling. Maybe it is going to see a counselor, a support group. Maybe it's just looking through a photo album and connecting with memories in that way. That said, just because you're not grieving in the way that you might have expected, or in the way that we often see depicted in television and the movies where a person is beside themselves crying, doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. Many people, as Litsa mentioned earlier, are a little more rational in their grief. They find they're more hands-on doers in the way that they cope and do things. They might be the one who plans the memorial service, or they might be the one who at the year mark might say, like, let's get together and remember our loved one in this way. And somebody might also just grieve in fits and starts. So you said you encountered a couple of triggers recently, and if you are encountering those triggers and really processing them and feeling those emotions, it may be that your grief just looks a little bit different than you expected it to look. So it's hard to tell, but I would encourage you to continue to connect with your loved one, their memory, and if there are certain emotions that are coming up and that are really tricky for you, maybe taking a little time to try and process that in whatever way works for you, through maybe journaling or talking to somebody.
Ray, hope that helps. Sorry for your loss. Litsa, we're all probably going to deal with grief at some point in our lives, but it seems like as a society, we're pretty bad at it. What's up with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're pretty bad at it. And I think it makes sense that we're pretty bad at it. We don't like the idea of death. And one of the things Eleanor and I talk about a lot is that I think people hesitate to even talk about the reality that oftentimes part of our grief is dealing with our own mortality. And it's interesting what a big taboo that is. So feelings are complicated, hard feelings, sadness, being present with someone who's feeling things like anger or guilt or blame or sadness or yearning. That's hard for people. We often don't get raised knowing how to be comfortable around those feelings. So I think that's one of the big challenges. And then the other part of it is that oftentimes it does bring up stuff about our own mortality. We've heard many grievers say to us, I didn't understand why after my child died or after my husband died, it felt like people were awkward or uncomfortable around me. And then I realized that in some way, I represented one of their biggest fears. And so talking to me made it real that they might live with something like that. And I've always found that to be a really profound way of thinking about why we as a society are sometimes not doing the best job supporting one another. Is we don't get trained. We don't get a handbook when we're kids. We don't learn it in high school. And then it also brings up a lot of our really deep fears about our own potential losses and our own mortality.
We'll leave it there. Litsa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Eleanor, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Litsa Williams and Eleanor Haley. They're mental health professionals. They're the co-founders of the grief managing website community. You can check it out. It's called What's Your Grief? You can also share your thoughts on the topic over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Wisconsin state lawmaker who says she's concerned about a plan to put F-35 fighter jets at a base in Madison. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. According to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, the number of pedestrian deaths in 2019 has already surpassed last year's total. Coming up, we'll talk about why they're on the rise and what pedestrians, drivers, and others can do to improve pedestrian safety. First, U.S. Air Force officials are continuing to consider a plan that could bring F-35 fighter jets to Madison. The public comment period ended late last week. Now a final decision is expected from the Air Force next year in March. But our next guest says she still has some unanswered questions about how the jets would impact nearby communities, especially the noise of the jets. Representative Chris Taylor is a Democratic member of the Wisconsin Assembly. She represents the 76th Assembly District, which includes Madison. She recently got back from a trip to Burlington, Vermont, to learn more about the impact of the F-35 jets stationed there. Representative Taylor, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What did you hear from community members about the F-35s there in Burlington?
Well, look, the basing of these F-35 planes, which typically have not been placed in the middle of dense residential neighborhoods, which is what the community of Burlington is like, they are very concerned about what the noise entails for their community. There's a lot of instability, a lot of stress, and I'd say a lot of chaos as residents try to predict, are they going to be able to stay in their homes? Some of the residents that we met with had been living in the South Burlington neighborhood that's going to be very much impacted for 57 years. So very, very tight-knit community, a community on edge, not knowing if they're going to be able to continue to remain in their homes.
Taking it back to Wisconsin now, you're concerned in part about the communities that the F-35s could affect in Madison. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, I represent some of Madison's neighborhoods and individuals who the Air Force has predicted will be most negatively and substantially impacted by the proposal. So I represent the Near East and some of our North Side communities that are going to be subjected to intense noise. These jets are not just a little louder than F-16s. The Air Force has estimated that they're between 2 and 4 times louder in different venues. So this is very, very serious for our community. The Air Force is also telling us that they're going to fly more of these planes simultaneously, meaning more are going to go up at once. That noise, the cumulative noise impact of that has not even been estimated for my community. So at the end of the day, after, you know, really reading everything, we just had an environmental impact statement. There were many attachments and other appendices to that statement from the Air Force. I really have to conclude that these types of jets are not appropriate for a dense residential community like Madison.
People have pointed to the F-16s, which are already based at the same airport. And some people have argued that, okay, the F-35s will be a little louder, but really not much more disruptive than people are used to at this point.
And that's just false. That's just not the evidence that we have. We are lacking some predictions that were included in other environmental impact statements. For instance, in Burlington, Vermont, the Air Force did estimate how they did a comparison between the F-16s and the F-35s at takeoff and landing. That comparison showed for the Burlington community the F-35s being 4 times louder. We did not get in the Madison environmental impact statement, we unfortunately did not get that kind of data. And our environmental impact statement, as I've detailed in numerous letters to the Air Force, is really lacking more specificity. But in general, I think you can read the information that we have, including the disparate impact that the noise is going to have on communities of color in Madison, low-income individuals, and particularly children who really suffer adverse health impacts from being exposed to this kind of noise. So we're going to have an intense impact from these jets in our Madison community that I don't think it's anything like, the noise isn't anything like we have flying in our skies right now.
Talking to State Assembly Representative Chris Taylor, Democrat from Madison, about a potential Air Force plan, a decision still on the way that would site F-35 fighter jets at a Madison airport. Representative Taylor, people have pointed toward the possible economic benefits. They say the current field and the plane station there are bringing a lot of money and jobs into the community. The F-35s would do the same and allow that presence to stay there where the F-16s might not. Are you concerned about the loss of that job, those jobs and that revenue, if the F-35s don't come here?
Well, the Air Force has said that bringing the F-35s to Madison will result in an additional 64 jobs. What proponents of the F-35 say incorrectly is somehow Truax is in danger if we don't bring the F-35 planes here. And that's not what the Air Force has told us. The Air Force has said those kind of statements are speculative. In fact, there would be other potential options for the Air National Guard here at Truax if we did not get F-35s, like more updated F-16s. So there are other options. And honestly, bringing 64 new jobs to my community and the Madison community is not worth the significant adverse impact that these jets could have on our community. And that means displacing people. You know, we have a real shortage here in Madison of affordable housing. The areas around the airport tend to be more affordable for families and individuals. We have subsidized housing around the airport. People who are going to be impacted may not have another option. And this noise is going to extend, I believe, far beyond the perimeter that the Air Force has identified. So it's a real threat to our quality of life in Madison. It's a threat to these neighborhoods. And I am concerned that this proposal is going to significantly denigrate our East and North Side communities, which are a substantial economic boost. This is where a lot of jobs are in our city on the North and East sides. The impact, the negative economic impact of these planes on our local businesses, on property values, on the city's tax base has also not been adequately looked at by the Air Force. So I requested that they take a look at those factors as well.
Some of your Madison area Democratic colleagues have supported this plan, and local Madison area Democratic officials have signed on as well. What do you make of the fact that even some of your Democratic colleagues are on board with this?
Well, look, I represent the community, some of the community most impacted. So my community, I believe, has not exclusively the most to lose, but they certainly have a lot to lose. And so, you know, I've made sure that we took this trip out to Burlington. There was a delegation that went out there because I wanted to talk to the people out in South Burlington, out in Winooski, about how they are being impacted. What do these jets sound like? You know, and they describe the sound of these jets as not comparable to the sound of F-16s. These jets rattle, you know, people describe these as vibrating internally, that this is a loudness and an intensity that they had not experienced. So, you know, my job is to represent the community that has elected me to represent them. And I have to say, it's really pretty much unprecedented to put these jets in such a dense residential neighborhood. There are 60,000 people who live within 3 miles of the Dane County Airport. There are other options for these jets. There are other places being considered that don't have nearly the negative impact on communities. So I believe very wholeheartedly that placing these jets in the middle of our community is going to denigrate our neighborhoods and really lessen the quality of life for our residents and have horrible, desperate impacts on communities of color. We have struggled in Madison with pernicious, persistent inequities. We just had a report last week showing the opportunity gap between white and African-American students in the Madison Metropolitan School District. These planes are going to fly over our schools, some of the most diverse schools in our city. That's going to lead to interruptions. That could lead, we know, to learning delays, to reading delays. So this is just not, we are not the appropriate site for this type of plane.
In our last few moments, I understand you're calling on the Air Force to release a new environmental impact statement. What are you looking for?
Well, look, I'm looking for the data that was provided to other communities. I'm looking at a comparison of the noise between our current F-16s and F-35s at takeoff and landing. My community doesn't even have that information. So I'm certainly looking for that kind of analysis that could give us a better idea. I mean, what we're really looking at is other environmental impact statements that had that kind of information to try to gauge what exactly the noise impact is going to be. What we know, what the Air Force is telling us, is it's going to be a lot louder. Well, we want a lot more information about what does that mean for people? How frequent is that loudness going to be? How intense is it going to be? How long is it going to last? Those are all basic questions that we really haven't received the answers to. So I believe my community deserves to know the answers to those questions, and I think the public has to have an opportunity to respond to that information.
Representative Taylor, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Representative Chris Taylor, Democratic member of the Wisconsin Assembly. She represents the 76th Assembly District. That includes Madison. She was with us today to talk about what she saw on a recent trip to Vermont to learn more about their F-35 fighter jets. Similar jets could be stationed at a field in Madison. Coming up, after some recent incidents of vehicles hitting pedestrians, we'll talk about how to improve pedestrian safety here in Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democratic Congressional Representative Mark Pocan joins us to talk about the latest news from Washington, D.C. Now, Milwaukee police say two more children, aged 6 and 4, were struck by a vehicle yesterday afternoon. A press release says they were in the street when they were hit and that the driver did not stop. Both kids were taken to the hospital. Police are still looking for a suspect and the vehicle. Earlier in the day, a funeral was held for two Milwaukee sisters, also 6 and 4. They were struck in a crosswalk by a hit-and-run driver last month. Their 10-year-old cousin was also injured. A 19-year-old man was eventually arrested and charged. And in Madison last night, a 37-year-old man with a revoked license was arrested after a crash that killed a pedestrian. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation says 46 pedestrians have been killed so far this year. Last year, there were 43 in the whole year. Nationwide, there were more than 6,200 deaths in 2018, up about 3.5% from the previous year. So, what can we do to make walking safer? Nick Jarmus is Midwest Director of Public Affairs for the American Automobile Association, or AAA. He's based in Madison. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how worried are you about this problem of pedestrian safety?
Well, you know, AAA has been concerned about pedestrian safety throughout our history, and we've done a lot of campaigns and educational programs, especially directed at young children. And it's so tragic to hear these stories of young lives taken as a result of these incidents. So we're really concerned about this, and we think it deserves a lot more attention and needs some solutions.
As I understand it, there's one bit of good news in the litany of bad news I just gave. The number of children as pedestrians killed in accidents has gone down over time, thanks in part to a really concerted effort in, say, school areas and things like that. So it sounds like if we try, we can make a difference.
That's right. You know, and the school areas, there are programs at AAA. It has our safety patrol program that we work with, you know, hundreds of schools, thousands really throughout the country on that. And those zones are more controlled. There's more supervision. And children are also in a more serious frame of mind, at least near school zones. So those are some factors that help. But when you're out in the communities, you know, further away from the schools, children are at particular risk. They tend to have less ability to judge what are safe gaps in traffic when they're crossing the street. They have less peripheral vision abilities than adults do. And they also have a difficulty identifying what direction sounds are coming from. So even if they hear a car coming, they often can't tell without seeing which direction it's coming from. And they also often assume that if they can see a car, that means that the driver of that car can see them. And unfortunately, we know that that's simply not true.
So that's a bit of good news, crashes involving kids as pedestrians going down. But the overall numbers are going up of pedestrian crashes. Do we have any idea why that would be, Nick?
Yeah, it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly. You know, our best ideas are that it does coincide with a sharp spike in distraction behind the wheel. You know, distraction has always been there, but with the advent of mobile technologies, that are being used by drivers while they're driving, really does seem to coincide with this uptick in pedestrian crashes. And, you know, distractions cut down on your reaction time, and it doesn't even have to be, something that you're looking down. We typically talk about texting or, holding phones, things that take your hands off of the wheel or take your eyes off of the road. But even cognitive distractions, which simply take your mind out of the task of driving, such as hands-free phone conversations or using voice-commanded controls in newer vehicles, can also be dangerously distracting.
Talking to Nick Jarmus from AAA about pedestrian safety on our roads in Wisconsin and around the country. Nick, let's take a look at what the AAA is telling people to help be more safe. And let's start with drivers. What are your messages? Sounds like the obvious one has to do with distraction. What other things are you telling drivers?
Absolutely. Staying focused and alert is paramount. And especially, there's so many new technologies on vehicles, but, those technologies are no replacement for a vigilant driver. And we've done some research on some of these collision avoidance technologies that are being built into vehicles, and we find that pedestrian safety is a serious weak spot for these technologies. According to our research, even under ideal conditions, when you have an adult pedestrian and the vehicle traveling at 20 miles an hour, there's only a 40% chance that it's going to pick up that pedestrian and stop in time to avoid a collision. The numbers go down under 20% when you're talking about children or you're talking about vehicles that are moving faster than 20 miles an hour. So being focused, being alert, first and foremost, the most important thing. The next thing is to slow down. Traveling at an appropriate speed in a residential area is going to increase your reaction time, but it's also going to significantly cut down the chances that should a collision occur, it will be a fatal collision. And the difference between 20 miles an hour and 30 miles an hour is huge. At 20 miles an hour, you're talking about an 18% chance of it being a fatal strike. At 30 miles an hour, that jumps up to 47% chance.
And we had a talk on the show a while back. A researcher had looked at how often people stopped at pedestrian crosswalks when a pedestrian is waiting to cross. This happened to me in Milwaukee, but it's probably true everywhere. The answer was almost never. We view them as very optional as drivers. What's the AAA message on crosswalks?
It is that crosswalks are mandatory. If there's someone waiting to cross, you need to stop, you need to slow down, you need to wait for them to cross. And so that's our number one recommendation for pedestrians themselves, is to make sure you're utilizing those crosswalks. But, you know, that's the place where pedestrians and drivers meet, quite literally on the road. And it's up to everyone involved in that meeting to ensure their safety of themselves and of the other person.
Are there changes in either laws or our road design or whatever that you're looking for to make pedestrians safer?
You know, not at this time necessarily. You know, the laws play a big part of it, but no one law is going to solve the issue. It has to be a combination of having the right laws, having the right road design, having proper enforcement, but also having a lot of education and awareness among drivers. You know, simply put, even with automated enforcement systems such as what are being discussed in Milwaukee for speed or red light running, those can't be installed everywhere that they're needed. At a certain point, motorists have to self-regulate themselves. They have to follow those laws simply because it's the right thing to do and that they want to keep people safe, and not just because they're afraid of getting a ticket when they come up on an intersection that is photo enforced or when they happen to see a police car, in the area. You need to follow those laws all the time.
And then what messages do you have for pedestrians to stay safe in a sometimes hostile road environment?
Well, first and foremost, stay on sidewalks as much as possible. If sidewalks are not available, stay off as far on the side of the road as you can. And facing traffic, that's one of the most frequent things that I personally see, is people walking with traffic. And the rule is if you're on a bike, you're supposed to ride with traffic. But if you're walking, you want to walk against traffic. That way you will see the car and be able to react and respond to a car that's coming towards you even before the car may even be able to see you. The other thing is to stay visible. Wear bright colored clothing. Stay in well-lit areas as much as possible. Stay alert yourself. Make sure you're not looking down at a phone or wearing headphones, especially when you are about to cross a street. And then also, following the rules yourself. Staying in, crossing at crosswalks. Following your traffic signals at signalized intersection and not the motorist signals. A lot of people, they look at for the green light and not necessarily the walk sign. And sometimes the intersections are set up, where drivers may have a green light moving in the same direction, but if there's turn arrows involved, you may, not be safe to walk at that point.
Do you think, Nick, are you optimistic that we can start moving the numbers back down again over the years?
I think so. I think by, putting more attention on it, putting more enforcement behind the laws that we have, addressing some engineering things by making sure crosswalks are more prominently visible for drivers would be helpful. But also just, emphasizing that drivers need to take responsibility with this. And the more that we can do to reduce distracted driving and simply increase speed compliance among drivers will go a long way to bringing these numbers down.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Nick Jarmus is the Midwest Director of Public Affairs for AAA. We talked to them about what pedestrians, motorists, traffic engineers, and policymakers can do to improve pedestrian safety. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says more than 6,200 pedestrians died last year, up from 4,100 a decade ago. Pedestrian deaths in urban areas are up 69% over that period. Interested to hear what you think. What are things like walking around your community? Do you feel safe crossing the street? Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Today is National Donut Day. But you say, Rob, didn't you tell it was National Donut Day 5 months ago? And I say, yeah, I say a lot of things. That sounds like something I might have said. But here's the real deal. For some reason, there are two dates that get celebrated by donut shops, among others, as National Donut Day. The other one is the first Friday of June. We dug into this a little bit. The website Mental Floss tracked down the history of the June Donut Day. It started as a Salvation Army effort to support volunteers who would bring food and treats, including donuts, to U.S. troops during World War I. Donate Day back home in the U.S. was started as a fundraising holiday to help support their efforts. That makes sense. But today's November Donut Day. That same Mental Floss article found some related themes, but they couldn't find a verified backstory to that one. So I'm leaning toward the June one. Plus, why in the world would we have a day to celebrate a sugary treat less than 1 week after Halloween when we're all still eating people's leftover candy in the Wisconsin public media break room? As much as I like donuts, and I really like donuts, I hereby announce my plan to renounce the November Donut Day. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.